Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Art. I'm your host, Ricardo, and I'm here today to talk to Craig Clunas about his latest book, Chinese Painting and Its Audiences, published by Princeton University Press in 2017. Welcome to the show, Craig.
Thank you very much.
Now, you've done an interview for the New Books Networks in the past, and for everyone who didn't know, I encourage you all to listen to a previous episode where Craig Clunas discussed his previous book, Screen of Kings, together with Carla Nappi. But anyhow, as this is tradition, could you still briefly introduce yourself, please?
Yes. Well, I'm currently Professor of the History of Art at the University of Oxford. I've been in this post for 11 years now. Prior to that, I've taught at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies, London University. I've taught at the University of Sussex. And I began my career as a museum curator. I worked for about 15 years in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London from the late 70s until the early 90s. I think of myself as a scholar of Chinese art. I've written a lot about the Ming period, but I also have strong interests in the 20th century. I've always taught the 20th century, and my current thoughts are more about more modern stuff. But the book that we're going to talk about looks at a span of things from the Ming to the 20th century, so it covers a range of my interests.
Absolutely. Thank you. Before we jump into the book, could you tell us also how you came to write Chinese Painting and Its Audiences?
Well, Chinese Painting and Its Audiences is also the title of a lecture series, which I gave as the Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. in 2012. So I was invited to give these lectures, to give six lectures, and they'd invited me, I don't know, it must be 3 or 4 years before you actually give them because they expect them to be something new. And I'd already been thinking about a project on these lines. So when I got asked to give the Mellon Lectures, I knew immediately that this was the project that I wanted to do. And then the Mellon Lectures are rather generously funded to the extent that there's always funding to produce a book out of the lectures. In fact, you're contracted to. You have to produce a book out of the lectures. And I was conscious this was only the second time in their history. They go back to the 1940s, but my series in 2012, which had this same title, Chinese Painting and Its Audiences, my series in 2012 was only the second time that they've been on a Chinese topic. The first set of Mellon lectures to be about Chinese art were given in 2000 by Lothar Lederhoser of Heidelberg University, and they turned into his book 10,000 Things, a kind of marvelous book. So I had a standard to aim at. And I was also thinking about something that was more art historical than the last project. You mentioned previous project, Screen of Kings, which is very much a kind of cultural history book. It's very much about Ming China. Although I hope it's of interest to people who don't work on China, it very much aims to be an intervention into thinking about the Ming period. So I wanted to do something that was deliberately aimed at a wider audience. So that's what the Mellon Lectures are supposed to be. They're public lectures. They're open to anybody. Anybody can come in and hear them. So ideally, you want to produce something which isn't just speaking to a very narrow or a very small specialist audience of your peers. You want something that tackles some of the big questions. So that was the kind of that was what was kind of going in my head as I was preparing these lectures over the years down to 2012, and then it took another 5 years working on the book, expanding the lectures, filling them out, thinking about, you know, because in a lecture you can say things and get away with it because people aren't allowed to kind of question you. But once you put it in a book and the book is going to have footnotes and the book is going to last, you feel you have to be a bit more, it's not about taking more care, but it's about taking a different kind of care and communicating in a slightly different way. So that's the kind of backstory to the book.
Okay, and the amount of lectures you gave, 6 in total, that is probably, I'm assuming, the amount of book chapters that you have in the book as well. So you start out with the beginning and ending, chapter 1, but then you go on to structure the book according to the following categories: the gentleman, the emperor, the merchant, the nation, and the 6th chapter is called the people. And so I was wondering, was it really the amount of lectures you were giving, or was there something else to this, how you divided the book?
Yeah, how I divided it. Well, no, those were the 6 lectures, you know, beginning and ending, and then those 5 themes you've just laid out. Those were the 6 lectures, and I suppose I did want the book to have a relationship to the lectures. There's a kind of immediacy about lecturing, and I didn't want to tear that structure up and start again at the beginning. So it's sometimes quite helpful to have a kind of an arbitrary structure imposed on you. You know, if it had been 4 lectures, the structure might have been slightly different. Or if they'd wanted 8, I'd have had to produce other stuff. So, no, it definitely is the case that the fact that I was required to give 6 lectures, that relates very much to the 6 main chapters of the book. There's a little introduction, and then there's a short conclusion. But the six chapters, I would hope that people who heard the lectures and then who read the book would feel that there was a relationship between them. I mean, I wanted that relationship to be there.
Okay, we'll start out. You mentioned the introduction, which we'll glance over because we'll touch upon all, I hope we'll touch upon all these topics later on in the interview. But we'll start out with the beginning and ending. In chapter 1, you try and trace back the, as I said, beginnings and endings of quote-unquote Chinese painting. The ending might be easier to establish, according to you. And you do so by referring to Huang Yongping's work from 1987 called A History of Chinese Painting and A Concise History of Modern Painting, after 2 minutes in the washing machine. Could you tell our listeners why this work is so important in relation to what it is that you're doing in your book?
Well, in a way, I'm not sure it's that important. It's a kind of attention-grabbing thing. I mean, I've found from years of teaching Chinese art that, you know, people always react very strongly to this. So what you've got here is in 1987, the artist Wang Yongping took these 2 art school textbooks, A History of Chinese Painting, which was originally written in Chinese, and A Concise History of Modern Painting, which was a Chinese translation of Herbert Reed's book, so by an English art historian called Herbert Reed. And he put these 2 in the washing machine and they cut it and for 2 minutes and destroys them. He destroys these books. They just come out as a pile of wet sludge, and then this pile of wet sludge is displayed. So it's very kind of attention grabbing. It has that kind of, I don't know if it's wow factor. It's maybe more a kind of ugh factor about it. But it's Huang Yongping. To me, what he's saying is, you know, the story that we've been brought up with is not good enough anymore. You know, apart from anything else, the separation into two completely different things. You know, once these two books have been in the washing machine, they're mashed up together into, you can't tell which is which. So in a way, and I'm not the first person to point this out, and you know, this is a very well-known work of art now. It's in lots and lots of survey books. It stands for one of those kind of startling works of the Chinese avant-garde from the 1980s that first grabbed the attention of a global audience. I knew that in the book I wasn't going to deal with kind of what you might call the world of contemporary art, because that seemed to me to be about something different, and not something that I'm not interested in, but something that I did not want to kind of take on at this stage. And so in a way, that moment in the 1980s is very much about the beginning of something, it seems to me, very much about the beginning of kind of a kind of Chinese contemporary art which demands global attention. But it's also therefore a way of closing off the story. So starting with that and saying it's a way of saying this is what I'm not going to deal with.
Then maybe let me ask a follow-up question, because you elaborate on the first Chinese painting in the album of Bahram Mirza in what is today's Iran. So basically I'm wondering if you could tell us more about this first Chinese painting.
Well, I mean, one of the things that you know, so I've worked a lot on the Ming period, and I've written a book about, you know, the artist Wen Zhengming, you know, whose dates are 1470 to 1559 in the Western calendar. What Wen Zhengming was doing, he didn't think of it as Chinese painting, nor did his audience think of it as Chinese painting. He thought of it as painting. Right? He just thought of it as painting. So for a number of years, and this goes back quite a long way. I mean, I first got interested in this problem about 11 years ago, 12 years ago, when I came to Oxford and I had to give an inaugural lecture. And I'm professor of art history at Oxford, but I'm the first person to hold that job to work on something that isn't the Western canon. So my predecessors, very distinguished scholars, have all worked on basically Italian Renaissance or Italian Baroque art. And I work on the Ming Dynasty. So I had to give this inaugural lecture. And I got interested in this question. Well, what are the first things to be described as Chinese paintings? And it's kind of obvious that it's not going to be within China itself that things get called Chinese paintings. It's going to be outside China that things get called Chinese paintings. And I was reading David Roxburgh's book about the Persian album, and I'd already been vaguely aware of, but I then came across, so in the mid-16th century, this album of paintings is assembled for a Persian prince. It has in it, obviously, calligraphy and painting from various parts of the Islamic world. It has at least one European image in it, and it has a number of Chinese images pasted into it, at least one of which is a good bit earlier than the album itself. So the album was made in the 16th century, and this picture of two grooms holding a horse appears to be an early Ming painting, so it dates probably from the first half of the 15th century, which is a period when there's a lot of diplomatic to-ing and fro-ing between the Timurid Empire in what is now Iran and Afghanistan and early Ming China. And when this early Ming picture was pasted into this album in the 15th century, it was given a kind of calligraphic caption in Persian, which says, you know, this is one of the good works of the Chinese masters. So in a way, I mean, it's slightly, again, attention grabbing. But I do think that, you know, it might not be the very first, but it's one of the first pictures to be described as a Chinese picture. And it's being viewed by an audience outside China, by an audience in Iran. And they're looking at it and they're thinking, this is a Chinese picture. This is what a Chinese painting looks like. So really the point I'm trying to make is that although the category Chinese painting has a long history. If we think of it in global terms, and we think of it as a term that obviously is put together outside China. So I'm not saying that Chinese painting was invented in the 15th century. Obviously, there are many, many things that we would now call Chinese painting that, back to the Song Dynasty or even the Tang Dynasty. But they were not being called Chinese painting at the time. So I got interested in this, and I just thought this is again a way of sort of trying to. Because really, I suppose the basic problem is that my experience now goes back quite a long way, or long enough. And when you talk about Chinese art to an audience of non-specialists, and that's what I was doing. Remember, I'm standing in the National Gallery of Art in Washington. And the National Gallery of Art in Washington is really the National Gallery of Western Art. It doesn't have any Chinese art in it, as people will know. If you want to see Chinese art in Washington, D.C., you go across the mall and you go to the Freer Sackler Gallery, and that's where the Chinese collections are. So the National Gallery of Art isn't really the National Gallery of Art. It's just the National Gallery of Western Art. So in a way, I'm trying to make problematic these kind of natural categories of separation, partly by saying that, people outside China have been looking at Chinese art for a long time. This is 600 years old, this early Ming picture that's pasted in this Persian album. And trying to get people to think about some of the problems. As I said, my experience is that people who aren't specialists say, oh, I don't know anything about Chinese painting. I know nothing about Chinese painting. But in fact, that's not true. In fact, they have very strong preconceptions, presumptions, they have a strong set of images of what Chinese painting is going to look like. And my argument is partly, or my argument in this chapter is that within art history, Chinese painting has always been present in art history as a discipline. There have always been, one of the most famous series of Mellon lectures is Ernst Gombrich's series from the 1950s, which became his book Art and Illusion. And in there, he gives us, Chinese painting. It's as if we already always knew what this thing is already always known about before it's been studied. And really what I'm then wanting to do in the rest of the book is step back and look at it a bit more. And I knew from the beginning that I wanted the thing to be chronological. So these chapters, The Gentleman, The Emperor, The Merchant, The Nation, The People, I could have called them, The Ming, The Qing, The Late Qing, The Republic, The People's Republic, but that has, that's a way of putting an audience, that's not a way of drawing people in, that's a way of pushing people away. So although the structure is broadly chronological, it's not presented to the audience with chronological labels.
So in chapter 2 called The Gentleman, you elaborate on this idea of, on the one hand, Chinese looking and discussing Chinese painting and foreigners looking and discussing Chinese painting. It's more about a Chinese audience at this point, though. And you discuss the popular visual trope of the four skills or four arts, Qin Qi Shu Hua, the zither, chess, calligraphy, and paintings. These paintings usually depict gentlemen, at least in the earlier period of the Ming Dynasty or mid-Ming. So gentlemen of wealth and taste who are involved in these one of these four activities, at least in the case of the former three, that is playing zither or chess or writing calligraphy. In the case of painting, however, you do this by really depicting incredible or giving amazing examples of painting. So in the case of painting, it is not the act of creating a painting, of making the painting, that seems to be considered the art or skill. So could you please elaborate on what it is that these gentlemen are doing instead?
I mean, at the core of the whole book is a lot of pictures of people looking at pictures, right? That's what I got interested in. That within the Chinese tradition, over a very long period, you get pictures which show people looking at pictures. As I gathered more and more of these, it became kind of clear to me that from the Ming period, and the Ming material is, you know, probably the material that I knew best at the beginning, so I kind of knew that material better than some of the later stuff. You never see a Ming painting which shows a gentleman painting, a Ming gentleman painting. Now, there are pictures of people with brushes in their hands in the Ming period, but many of them are historical. So there are scenes like the elegant gathering in the Western Garden, which is a kind of Song dynasty, an earlier gathering. They're kind of historical paintings, right? They're deliberately historical. Or there are pictures which show people painting, but they are lower status professional artisans. So, you know, there's a famous Chiu Ying painting, Spring Morning in the Han Palace, showing an empress having her portrait painted. Well, A, this is a historical painting because it's set back in the Han Dynasty. And B, it's a portrait painter. So it's an anonymous kind of portrait painter. It's not, what you never see is the act of what we call literati painting being pictured. Instead, what you get is all these pictures of people looking at painting. So that when I think about Qin Qi Shu Hua, the four skills, the zither, chess, calligraphy, and painting, it struck me as kind of, at the very least, kind of worth thinking about that the representation of Hua painting as a kind of topic, as a theme, is not to show people painting, but to show people looking at painting, as if somehow looking at painting stood for the discourse of painting itself. And so that's really what I wanted to think about, the Ming idea, and obviously this is a Ming elite idea, that painting is that the category is somehow completed by the act of viewing, that it's the viewer that makes a painting a painting. It's not a painting until it's been viewed, until acts of connoisseurship have been performed on it.
I'm just wondering whether you think it worthy on expanding on the idea of meta peinture or meta pictures, and whether you want me to ask the next question, this act of looking led to the production, or whether you think it better to jump right into the chapter 3, The Emperor.
I don't mind talking about the meta, you know, about this, because apart from anything else, I suppose, so Victor Stoiketa's book, The Self-Aware Image, was one that, you know, I read it, I thought this is a kind of completely brilliant book. And I learned a huge amount from it, but, and there's a big but, which is that he seems to think that this activity of meta-painting, i.e. paintings within paintings, is somehow distinctively European, you know? And he then ties it to the European idea of modernity. So I'm afraid at that point, kind of, you know, red lights start going off for me. You know, all my career, I seem to have been having to deal with scholars of European art who say European art is distinctive because it has X or Y or Z, and they haven't thought about anything other than European art. And the minute you start to look at Ming painting, it's full of these meta paintings are everywhere. You know, these pictures within pictures, or pictures that kind of play with the fact of, is this a picture or is this a window? You know, they're all over the place. So, you know, full of respect as I am for that as a great work about European art, I'm afraid it just isn't good enough now to talk about, you know, to talk about one regional tradition and call that art. I mean, in a way, that brings us back to the Huang Yongping work, you know, that a concise, Herbert Reed's concise history of modern art isn't a concise history of modern art. It's a concise history of modern European and North American art, as if that could stand for the whole thing. And, you know, I like to think that, you know, my whole career has been devoted to kind of trying to say, well, no, you know, you can do valuable and important and interesting work on Europe, but don't take the European stuff and say there is this distinctive thing called metapeinture, right, which is somehow, you know, an index of modernity being something purely European. So as with a lot of my work, there are elements, you know, there are things that are written against, you know, the things that I want to say, and then there are things where I just want to say, I'm sorry, but you have to take a wider canvas in order, you just can't say that about one regional tradition, you know? I mean, if I said, you know, the distinctive thing about Chinese art is that it paints the flowers and, you know, that Chinese art paints flowers and the natural world, you know, any historian of European art would say, well, I'm sorry, what about European, you know? And it has to go both ways. It has to go both ways.
These viewerships and the reception of painting is something you, as we already said, elaborate on in each and every chapter. And around roughly around 200 years after the visual trope of men looking at painting seems to fall out of fashion in China, the subject of the female painter in action seems to experience an upsurge. This is around 1800. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on these depictions of female painters painting and why they are important for the following chapter, chapter 3, called The Emperor.
One of the things I would want to say is that I don't have all the answers, you know. I certainly don't have all the answers. And I find this I mean, I suppose I could be challenged on two counts. Somebody could just say, well, look, you've got it wrong. Here's a load of examples which show that what you're claiming is not the case. And you know, that would be fine. I mean, it wouldn't be fine, but I'd just have to live with it. You know, but the fact is that, you know, I got, again, just struck by the fact that as I looked at more pictures, and I suppose the thing I want to stress is I looked at a lot of pictures in order to put these lectures together, and to write this book. You know, I searched for things.
And sorry to interrupt, but the book is visual evidence for that as well, because it's absolutely beautifully and lavishly illustrated.
Well, thank you for saying that. Thank you. I'm pleased that you feel that. So, you know, I suddenly come across the fact that, you know, these pictures of gentlemen looking at pictures start to die out in the Qing period. And then you get this burst in the Qing of female painters. Now, I mean, one could come at this from a number of angles. You know, there's definitely, I'm thinking of Susan Mann's work here on women, you know, elite women in China's long 17th century, where, you know, it's clearly the case that as the Qing goes on, the cultural practices of elite high status women come to be more visible within culture. And I think one of the ways in which they're more visible is that they are then pictured within. But why certain, I mean, I think certain tropes, certain subject matters die out in Chinese painting because they get hackneyed, you know, they get over commercialized, they get overused, they become cliches. All, you know, Chinese picturing, all forms of Chinese picturing in the last 600 years have had to negotiate the fact that pictures are commodities, they are for sale. Picturing is a high cultural practice, but it can also just, you know, pictures can be bought and sold. And therefore, it seems to me that certain things die out just because they get worn out, they get exhausted, they get overused. and new subjects kind of appear, or new styles appear. But I do not have, you know, a slam dunk answer. It's a great question, but I do not have a kind of, well, here's the answer kind of answer as to why this stuff, why certain kinds of images die out and certain appear. If we're thinking about the kind of the relationship of female painters to chapter two, I mean, obviously, you know, there's a whole kind of body of material showing, viewing within the context of imperial courts, and most of it 18th century, you know, a lot of it Qianlong period. So this did enable me to kind of move on from the Ming and think about the Qianlong period, think about the kinds of images that are being produced in the imperial court, which are often kind of distinctively new types of subject matter, new types of scale, for example. You know, they're colossally big or tiny small, many of these things. You know, you're trying also in a lecture series, and I hope also in the book, to kind of provide some hooks. You want people to come back next week. So there has to be a bit of a cliffhanger at the end of each lecture, where you hope that people are going to think, well, that was interesting. Let's come back next week and see what he's got to say about you know, taking that a bit further.
And I think you do that quite successfully with, you know, ending the second chapter with these female artists in action. And it seems to me, maybe I misread this, but as if, you know, you make a point of the male gaze that comes into play when we look at the emperor, and the Qianlong emperor is a great example, the male gaze that kind of subsumes this multi-ethnical Qing empire under his own eyes in the form of paintings. And you mentioned the very large scale paintings and all the other elaborate productions that were made at the Qing court.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's always a risk about, you know, it's too easy to get captured by that gaze sometimes. I mean, you know, one doesn't want to think that, you know, the Qianlong court is not the only game in town in 18th century China. And I suppose that would therefore, you know, this book is not a comprehensive study of absolutely everything that happened with the viewing of painting in China between the Ming and the 20th century. You know, it doesn't claim to have that degree of absolute comprehensiveness. So it's themes within the viewing of Chinese painting. Let me also say, and I, you know, I think, you know, one would, I hope this is obvious, but a book like this is massively indebted to the scholarship that people have done on specific themes and specific topics. You know, if you set out to do this kind of overview type thing, you have to be very dependent on what other people have done. I've used other people's scholarship respectfully. I think there's, you know, been some great work by younger scholars, great work continued by older scholars as well, you know, in the past 20 years. And here I'm trying to sort of pull some of that together. And some of that great work has been about the kind of the particular visuality of the Qing imperial court. You know, I couldn't not use that material. I thought, this is great stuff. I want to build on this scholarship. I want to try and tie it in with other stuff that's going on. Because I think everybody wants to have their work kind of used, you know. I mean, they want to have it used respectfully and they want to be properly acknowledged. And I hope I've done that throughout this book. But, you know, I didn't make all of this out of my own head. I worked with the work that other people have done on specific topics, and I couldn't have done it without that.
And you mentioned, I mean, you acknowledge that as well in the introduction, very kindly. But if we come back to chapter three, The Emperor, even if this is just one example of how the history of Chinese painting was written in a way, I was wondering if you could go on to elaborate on how the imperial court was the site of both the production and the destruction of painting.
I suppose what I meant by that was that what struck me was that there are two kind of contradictory things going on at the imperial court in the Qianlong period. So one is the creation of the canon of Chinese painting through things like Shiqu Baji and the kind of, well, apart from anything else, the canonization of Dongqi Chang as the great connoisseur of all time, you know, well established. You know, the Qianlong emperor models his own calligraphy style on Dongqi Chang. You know, Dongqi Chang's ideas become the kind of, you know, they have a kind of quasi-official, quasi kind of state view. So that state view is very, very, you know, that the Qianlong filter on pre-Qing painting has been very powerful down to the 20th century, not least because, you know, it's in the Qianlong period that the imperial collections are formed that become the collections of the Palace Museum, and then when those two collections are split in the 40s, you know, the collection in Taipei becomes, if you like, the collection that American scholars, Western scholars have most access to, you know, so it plays a large part in kind of defining what we think of today as the canon of Chinese painting. So that's one impulse. But the other impulse is there's all this other weird stuff going on, right? So all things like these Tong Jinghua that Christina Kleutgen has written a marvelous book about, these kind of large scale fixed point perspective things. There's all this kind of interaction with Western forms of picturing. You know, there's a whole load of stuff going on at the court, which is absolutely not the canon of Chinese painting as we know it today. So I suppose that's what I meant by the court is both the site of the creation of the canon and the kind of subverting, maybe destruction of the canon is the wrong word, but there's a kind of subversion of the canon going on at the imperial court through the great range of other kinds of picturing, including things like religious picturing, you know, including things like portraiture, imperial portraiture, that is very, very different from the kind of literati canon as filtered through the Qianlong reading of Dongqi Chang. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And this ties in perfectly with the next chapter, which is The Merchant.
Yeah, I mean, partly because, you know, courts are also centers of, you know, of great kind of commercial activity. And in a way, this chapter, although the chapters are broadly chronological, The Merchant takes us back, you know, it steps back into the Ming as well and looks at some of these pictures of urban landscapes which have within them meta painting or scenes of the viewing of painting, but very much not the viewing of painting in a kind of connoisseurly gentleman sitting in a garden setting, but the connoisseurship of painting as painting is in its commodity phase, as painting, you know, painting in the shop, you can see people going around the antique shops and shopping for painting. I just love that, you know, that stuff. I think some of it is kind of extremely, extremely interesting. And then it gave me a chance to talk about the 19th century and some of the ways in which merchant collectors in the Qing period, and people involved in trade with the West, people involved in trade with Japan, the roles that they played in the kind of formulation of canonical forms of Chinese painting through, for example, you know, The great Cantonese merchant collectors of the early 19th century have what we would think of as impeccably canonical taste. Who do they like? They like Shen Zhou, they like Wen Zhengming, they like Dong Qicheng. But they're also, these are the kind of people who are at the same time paying to have their portraits done in oils by either by European artists or by European or by Chinese artists who've received a European training. So again, I mean, I think thinking about it, I'm always trying to question the existence of pure essences. I'm always trying to show how entangled and complex, and therefore, in my view, more interesting, the body of material is. This is definitely an attempt. It's not a comprehensive book by any means, but it still attempts to look across a wide range of types of images. It attempts to say not how can we define Chinese painting, but it attempts to show how kind of the actual range of actual works of art that comes down to us from the last 600 years is wonderfully too diverse and wonderfully too interesting to admit of any very narrow kind of pure essential definition.
And yet that seems to be what art historians in the past, both in China and outside, have done. Or not?
Well, I mean, you could say that this is one of the things that art history has done, you know, that art history has always had, art history as an academic discipline is founded on this idea of, you know, well, it's founded on this idea of schools, you know, so if we go back to European, you know, the European early modern and somebody like Giorgio Vasari, what Vasari's interested in is saying, well, what's different between the art of, how does the art of Venice differ from the art of Florence, right? I suspect that somebody, you know, a visitor from, if there had been a visitor from Ming China who'd seen kind of European 16th century art, I think they would have felt it all looked the same, essentially. But you know, for Vasari, it's very important to get, what is the essence of Florentine art? What is the essence of Venetian art? And he comes up with this, well, Florentine art is all about line and disegno and drawing, and Venetian art is all about color. And then Winckelmann in the 18th century, and then in the 19th century, when you get galleries, you know, you've got schools, you know, the National Gallery, you know, it's still about putting all the Dutch stuff together and putting all the kind of North Italian stuff together and putting all the French stuff together. And then in the 20th century, you get somebody like the great, refugee art historian, so Pevsner, when he comes to Britain, actually he wasn't a refugee, but Pevsner comes to Britain and, you know, he writes, you know, he gives a famous series of lectures in the 1950s called, you know, The Britishness of British Art, you know. And really that, the Britishness of British art, the Frenchness of French art, the Chineseness of Chinese art, the Indianness of Indian art, the Yoruba-ness of Yoruba art, that's very kind of deeply inscribed into art history as an academic discipline, I feel. And something that, you know, we're only really beginning to think about, how comfortable are we with this? What are the problems with this? Is that really the way that, is that really the mode? Because, I mean, I suppose what gets me is that in order to do, you can always do that. You can always say, well, Chinese art is all about X, or British art is all about Y. But in order to do that, you've got to leave out large chunks of the evidence. You've got to pick a series of pictures. I mean, so that if I say Chinese art is all about expressive brushwork and a complete lack of interest in the mimetic, I could give you six lectures that make that case. But in order to make that case, I'd have to just like not show you all the counterexamples, all the pictures which come down to us from the past, which are maybe about something else. And I just think that, I mean, the reason Chinese art is so wonderful is it's not all about one thing. I mean, that seems to me to be part of its greatness. Its greatness lies not in its narrowness and purity. Its greatness lies in its diversity.
And this book is, at the very least, a testimony to this great diversity. But it is much more as well, because it looks at the history of art by way of looking at the different audiences and spectators. We've talked about the literati or scholarly elites and their meta paintings, and we've mentioned the emperor and the imperial workshop, who were both active producers of paintings and participants in writing a canon. In chapter 4, we move on to another kind of audience, that of the merchant, who, although mostly in the southern port cities such as Guangdong, far removed from imperial court in Beijing, nevertheless also functioned as important intermediary, or gatekeepers, if you will, of what was to be traded as painting. As you make very clear in this chapter and the following, however, there was exchange and interchange between these two, of course. As such, the commercial view, the view of the merchant and the consumer, is every bit as much part of what makes painting painting, as is the disinterested gaze of the gentleman, whom we've looked at just before. The rhetoric, however, was often quite different from what was actually happening. And I was thinking of taking the example of the merchant Pan Zhongwei, as you do in the book, but we could talk about anything else as well. And he collected works of Dong Qitang and other, you know, literati painters, as we call them today, whilst at the same time mediating trade with oil paintings done by Chinese artists in China for foreign audience. So in that way, in your words, trade has always acted to make impossible the purity of painting. And we've talked about this, you know, this pure essence that is non-existent before. But I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about this seeming disjoint between art historical narratives on the one hand and global trade in the 19th century on the other.
Sure. In some ways, I think one of the key words in that sentence is always. Because I think, you know, there are ways in which we could go back in time, right back into the Ming period. If we had better evidence, I'm sure we could go further back into the Song period and talk about, for example, I think that it's highly likely that specific types of image for foreign audiences were being made in China long before the kinds of Chinese export painting that we're familiar with in Guangdong from the 18th and 19th centuries. And we do have a few examples of that. So, for example, we have these images which we know were produced in Ningbo or in other port cities in the Ming period, which must have been for Japanese customers because they show specifically Japanese deities that had no meaning for a Chinese audience. So these are things that were painted in China for Japanese audiences. And I suspect that there are certain kinds of religious images. The workshops of Ningbo were producing those kinds of images for Japanese audiences, way back into the Song period. But when we get to the Qing, to the 18th, and in particular, I think to the 19th century, we've just got physically a huge quantity more evidence. And I find it quite sort of piquant that, you know, the very first book I ever wrote, the first book that's got my name on the spine, is a book that I wrote in the early 1980s when I was a V&A curator, and it's called Chinese Export Watercolors. And the V&A has quite an, like many, many British museums, the V&A has a kind of extensive collection of these watercolors, and really hasn't known what to do with them. You know, they've never been part of the story of Chinese art, and they've never been part of the story of European art either, because, you know, they're produced in China. So they are themselves kind of troubled and troubling objects. And in a way, I'd thought about these right at the beginning of my career. And I've always been interested in them. I've never lost interest in them. And I wanted to come back and think about some of those images and the ways in which they both are and are not part of the story of Chinese art. And by kind of not being part of Chinese art, they act to define the boundaries of what Chinese art is, or at least they've done so up until very recently. I mean, I think it's really interesting that, you know, there's much more interest in this kind of object in China now. And there have been publications in Chinese and exhibitions of material from the British Library, from the B&A have been shown in China. So there's a beginning, you know, of an attempt to think, well, how would we fit these things in? How could these things be part of this thing called Chinese painting? But I would stick to my view that for most of their history, they've acted rather they've acted as the boundaries of that category, of showing us what doesn't count. And I think that becomes quite important. And this is not a point that I developed in the book, but I think is one that I would want to develop maybe in future. They're part of the problem of why certain kinds of modern Chinese art, I'm talking about the earlier part of the 20th century, but why certain kinds of modern Chinese art also get sort of written out of the story as not really being Chinese.
Excellent. Thank you. This ties in nicely with the following chapter, chapter 5, The Nation, in which we move on and into the 20th century. And Chinese painting becomes a sort of intimately intertwined co-production of sight, of sites, as you call it. And you know, you talk about this co-production of Chinese and Western, and how these terms are kind of obsolete in a way already in previous chapters as well. But in the 20th century, Chinese painting also reached a truly global audiences. And so I would like you to talk a little bit more about the development of painting and the many art historical discourses and alternative voices, if you will, that were happening at the same time taking place.
Well, I think one of the points I'd want to start from, what do I mean by kind of co-production? I suppose to an extent here, I'm backtracking on things I've kind of written earlier, or on the way I'm trying to be clearer about some of the things that I've written earlier. So, you know, about 20 years ago, I did this book for Oxford University Press, which I called Art in China. And the introduction to that makes a big song and dance. Of course, this is completely meaningless when the book is translated into Chinese. But in English, I would submit that there's a significant difference between the concept of Chinese art and the concept of art in China. The Chinese art is about an essence, a category, a kind of bounded thing. And so one of the ways I've noticed that people have often read that is they read that as if I'm saying that the category of Chinese art is some kind of external imposition. And in particular, it's a kind of Orientalist imposition. You know, it's part of 19th and early 20th century ideas, which kind of essentialize and reify Chinese culture, or lots of different aspects of Chinese culture. And one of them is Chinese art. I think in this book, what I'm trying to make more clear is that I don't think that Chinese art is an essence which has always existed since the dawn of time, which would be one older way of looking at it. But nor do I think that it is a simple imposition from outside. What I think it arises out of is a very complex set of dialogues and interactions and back and forth and to and fro, which is both a back and forth and a to and fro of ideas. It's a back and forth and a to and fro of people. And above all, it's a back and forth and to and fro of art objects, which actually, you know, physically move across the globe and appear in different places and start to appear in Europe from, you know, the 16th century, the whole kind of Wunderkammer, Kunstkammer kind of phase of collecting, and which get a particular impulse once you start to get museums in Europe, museums in North America, collecting this category that for them is Chinese art. And it's not simply about they have invented this category, because they are themselves looking at what people in China are saying about this, and the people in China are looking at what people are saying in the West about this. So that's what I mean by kind of co-production. You can't say that this concept, Chinese painting, as it develops in the more modern period, you can't say that it's either completely Chinese and indigenous in its creation, nor is it completely extraneous and foreign. It is the result of some form of to and fro and interaction and engagement, and it's hard to find the right words for it, and that's why, I mean, co-production maybe isn't the best term. I'd be interested if you've got a better term, or if anybody else thinks they've got a kind of better way of explaining what's going on. I know what I feel is going on there. I'm finding it kind of difficult to maybe to express it with quite the lucidity that I would hope for.
I think you expressed it quite well in the book, and you make these points very clear. And as such, it almost feels as though you are somewhat flying in the face of previous scholarship, if you will, which seems to me what you're doing in chapter 6, The People, as well, where you elaborate on the people replacing the nation as the central enabling discourse of power and culture in the People's Republic of China after 1949, and how Chinese painting came to be seen as a totem of Chineseness, mostly within China, and then especially, I know I'm separating, you know, China here and the rest. I'm aware of this, but it seems that at the same time, especially in Europe and North America, during the aftermath of the founding of the PRC and during the Cold War, the reception of Chinese art seems to have taken on a very different art historical narrative. And you're kind of politicizing these common art historical rhetorics of the time, which all stipulate, most of them stipulated, that the scholarly elite class of the past was the one and only true and great art of painting ever produced in China. And for me, this point was really important because this is still how I first learned about Chinese painting when I started studying at university.
I'd come back, you know, the nation in chapter 5 and the people in chapter 6 are still seen, or I'm still trying to think about them as kinds of audience. I mean, obviously they're not there's a sort of shift there, isn't there? You know, the gentleman, the emperor, the merchant. We can kind of imagine a gentleman, an emperor, a merchant, but the nation and the people are not imaginable as individuals. I mean, they're very deliberately not imaginable as individuals. I suppose it's partly a question of who is painting for, who's painting for. And I suppose I'm arguing that in the late 19th century, in the Republican period, there develops this idea that painting, and that would mean both contemporary painting and the painting of the past, are for the nation. So that, you know, the art, the painting of the Song and Yuan and Ming and Qing periods comes to be seen as China's heritage. You know, this concept of the nation's heritage. And that's obviously linked to the development of museums in China, the development of a discourse of art history in Chinese, the kind of tentative developments of a discourse of art history about China in the European languages. And then after 1949, well, who is art for? Well, that's a kind of no-brainer of a question because, you know, the Mao's talks at the Yan'an Forum, you know, tell us what art is for. Art is for the people. So in a way, the kind of titling of those chapters was sort of almost easier than the titling of the earlier chapters. And I think it's kind of almost inescapable that in these later periods, in the 20th century, and this is two chapters where I'm trying to write about the 20th century. I mean, perhaps I should say that although I haven't written very much about the 20th century up to now, and most of what I've written has been about the Ming period, ever since I left the V&A Museum in the early 1990s, I've always taught a course on 20th century Chinese art. So I've been teaching courses on, and of course, when I started, it was just 20th century Chinese art. It went down to the 1990s, and now the course that I teach goes down to, you know, 2018. You know, it kind of goes down to now. So I've always taught this, and I've always thought about it. And indeed, even when I worked in the museum in the 1980s, I think I was part of that move, which was widespread at the time, to take the 20th century a bit more seriously in its own terms. So I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that when I joined the V&A in the late 1970s, the prevailing sense in the field, certainly in the museum, was that Chinese art came to an end with the death of the Qianlong Emperor. You know, end of the 18th century, end of Chinese art. Certainly the museum was not collecting anything 19th and 20th century. And I was part of a kind of generation of curators that said, well, no, we want to kind of look at this material. So I've always been kind of interested in this material and always thought about its kind of problems. But this was thinking about its audiences, and you can't, obviously, when you get to the 20th century, you can't separate the Chinese audience from the global audience. Many of the key players in China were, you know, formed as intellectuals by the experience of study in the West. You know, the key Western writers about it were many of them formed by long years of residence in China. You know, the kind of this is over here and that is over there aspect, which art history has always been keen on. You know, art history has always been keen on, I sort of said this earlier, I think, in the interview, you know, it's always been keen on sort of purity and boundaries and hasn't been so keen on messing things up. I mean, the extreme example of that, you know, you go back to the 19th century, Victor Segalen writes a book about Chinese sculpture and he leaves out all the Buddhist sculpture on the grounds that Buddhist sculpture isn't really Chinese because Buddhism came from India. Now, nowadays, we think that's completely crazy. Nobody would teach a course on Chinese sculpture and leave out, you know, Dunhuang or Longmen or Datong. You know, they just would not do that. But it's still perfectly possible to teach a course on Chinese painting and just talk about certain kinds of image, you know, just talk about that kind of literati painting. Now, the kind of the ideas I'm pursuing now, and these are ideas that I've been thinking about since I finished the book, are the ways in which, particularly in the Republican period, the ideas that we now take for granted about the canon of Chinese painting, about the dominance of the literati tradition, to what extent are those actually kind of pre-modern ideas? I mean, I'm not saying they're not pre-modern ideas, but to what extent are they given a very particular spin in the early 20th century by Chinese intellectuals who, for quite understandable reasons, do want to, you know, for quite understandable political reasons, want to solve this question of what is really Chinese? What is it that we're hanging on to? What is our heritage? What is valuable? What are we taking forward into the future? It's more than completely understandable why people in the early 20th century should want to do this. And I'm not kind of like blaming them for doing it or saying they should have done something else. But I think that we do need to think about, that in thinking about the past, that we can't write history without always at the same time writing historiography, and we can't do historiography without doing history at the same time. You know, I don't think these are two separate things. Or, you know, let's write a historiographical account and then do the proper history, or let's just do straight history and forget about the problems of historiography. It seems to me that so much of the account that we have of the art of China's past was a kind of running before we could walk, you know, that the overviews were written long before the detailed work was done. And, you know, maybe I'm as guilty of this as the next person, but that we kind of did these surveys and overviews really before we'd done a lot of the detailed work, and that there's a whole load more detailed work to be done on specific periods, specific theories, specific artists. But I am interested, the ideas that I want to take forward now, I hope into a next book, are ideas about the ways in which what people thought and did and the art that they made in the early 20th century has conditioned the ways that we think about the art of the pre-modern period.
That sounds like an absolutely fascinating book, and I'm looking forward to reading it. I suppose to conclude this interview, I'd like you to talk about ways. I suppose you just mentioned one, your new book, forthcoming book or book project at least. But I'd like you to talk about ways in which we can move forward and away from the many biases that you've kind of laid open throughout the book, Chinese Painting and Its Audiences. And in the very last sentence of your book, you suggest that we ought to start thinking about and thinking with Chinese paintings. And yet these biases are also reflected not just in our museum collections and scholarships, but perhaps most importantly today, also reproduced in online, on the internet and in digital databases that we often work with. And so I was wondering, what do you think how do you think we can aim at succeeding at a more globalized approach to?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a problem that I worry about a lot, that I don't really have a solution to. But I worry that we kind of kid ourselves that we now have access to everything. I mean, it's getting ever so much better. I mean, when I came to Oxford 11 years ago, Art Store was a relatively new project at that point. And I remember at the time there was very little Chinese art on Art Store. It was very heavily biased on European art. And it's got ever so much better since then. I mean, the people at Art Store have put a lot of effort into it. But what have they done? What they've done is they've digitized the museum collections. And that's obviously the sensible thing to do. What else would you do? How else could you start? But if the problem is that those collections were formed with a certain set of presuppositions about what did and what did not constitute Chinese art, then you're kind of left with a kind of digitized version of the situation as before. I worry, if we think about these huge projects in China to kind of publish great volume, I can't remember what the name of the series is, but, vast volumes of kind of all the paintings in all the museums in China. But if you dig into it, what you'll see is that these are selections. They are not the whole thing. They're not everything that there is. So there's always a kind of selectivity. There's always a kind of agenda there. And this is particularly problematic because, as I'm sure many people know, it's getting harder and harder, I think, to get access to actual museum collections. It's very hard to get access to museum collections in China. It's not that easy to get access to museum collections. It's better in Europe. It's better in North America. But, it's getting harder to get kind of unmediated access to just, you can't rock up at a museum nowadays and just say, like, show me what you've got. You will be directed to kind of databases and so on, which often have been filtered in terms of, we'll digitize all the important stuff. But of course, if you digitize all the important stuff, you've kind of already made the decision about what it is that matters, what it is that should be kind of, so you kind of work with it. I mean, to be utterly melodramatic about it, there's a great feminist slogan, isn't there, that the master's tools will never demolish the master's house. And if the tools we've got are the tools I base this partly on my own kind of experience as a museum curator. Museum collections were usually, I don't think it's controversial to say that every museum collection had a kind of agenda behind it. The usually agendas about quality or about comprehensiveness or about kind of, and therefore it's very difficult to make those collections then say something different. Collections say what it is that they were formed to say. They're not raw data. a museum collection is not like a library full of books. I mean, obviously, libraries full of books have their own agendas and their own silences and their own exclusions. But it's different with a museum. And time and again, curators now want the collections to say something new or something different about changed agendas. But it's very, very difficult, in my view, to get collections to do that. So one problem is, like, we've lost very large quantities of the material from the past. And I think we have to start by recognizing that what we've got from the past, let's take the Ming just as an example, what we've got from the Ming is only a fraction of what was ever created, but it isn't an equal fraction. So there might be certain kinds of thing where I'm making these figures up, but imagine that there are certain categories of material where 5% of what was created survives today. And there might be other categories where, you know, only 0.5% of what was created survives today. And even more, there might be categories where 0% or close to 0% of what was created survives today. And you know, what survives today is not necessarily the best guide to what existed. And it's certainly not the best guide to what was most important. And in particular, kind of, you know, the wider spread of pictures through a culture, you know, the kind of the lower end of stuff, the lower quality things. You know, there's been just colossal losses of that material, which make it very difficult. Now, I mean, that's not just a problem in Chinese art. That's a problem, you know, for the art, studying the art of any time and any place. But I think it has particular twists in China, which are also related to the difficulties of access to the stuff that is sitting in museums labeled as poor quality, you know, fakes, not very interesting. I mean, the late James Cahill, you know, towards the end of his life, he did, you know, he was doing great work, I think, in trying to look at stuff that had been left outside the canon. And I'm certainly not saying I'm the only person kind of doing this. It's a more widespread trend. And I'd make the point that we don't want to stop looking at the canon as well. Dongqichang is visual culture too. Visual culture doesn't mean all the things that aren't Dongqichang. It means Dongqichang and all the other things as well. I think that's a point I just think you can't stress often enough.
As a sort of sidetrack, and I think this again ties in nicely with what we were talking about, you know, accessing material, be it online or offline. You've agreed to talk about the mechanics of producing such a elegantly and lavishly illustrated book. And so I was wondering if you could just, you know, for the last few minutes, tell our listeners a bit more how you came to publish these lectures, expand on the Mellon lectures that you've given, that you've started out with, and then, you know, every step along the way to produce this book.
Sure. Yeah. Because I think we don't talk about these things often enough, you know, or we do talk about these things very much to one another. This is the kind of, you know, wherever two art historians are gathered together, they will start to complain about the difficulty of sourcing images for publication. But we don't talk about these things sort of very much in public. So I'm absolutely kind of delighted to have the opportunity to kind of credit and thank some of the people who sort of made this possible. So the Mellon Lectures, you give the Mellon Lectures and you sign a contract that you will provide Princeton University Press with a book. And then the National Gallery of Art in Washington is responsible for doing the work to source the pictures for you. And anybody who's ever sourced the pictures for a book will know that to have somebody else do it for you is just the greatest privilege and the greatest treat in the world. I mean, I've done it myself for a number of books. You know, I know what it costs, you know, costs financially. And here it didn't cost me anything. There are funds that the National Gallery of Art, the Mellon funding, supports that. But even more to work with, you know, and I'd love to have an opportunity to thank or in public to again thank a wonderful lady who I've never met called Ingrid Jung. Ingrid worked for the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. And Ingrid sourced the pictures from Chinese museums for me. and from sources around the world. And Ingrid was fantastically tenacious, fantastically patient. You know, again and again, she would say, well, you know, I've got this version of it, but I'm sure we can get a better one if I try harder and go for it again. So, you know, to thank Ingrid and to thank Michelle Comey, my editor at Princeton University Press, it's a real privilege to produce a book that has this kind of support. I just wish that every author in the world, and in particular kind of authors at the beginning of their careers, because that's when they need it best. So if anybody out there wants to kind of leave a very large fund of money, it would be to provide kind of picture research facilities for young art historians at the start of their career, so that somebody will take that burden off them and do it. I'm very grateful that somebody took that burden off me. I'd love to see that potential, that possibility made available to other people.
Perfect. What more is there to say, Craig? I thank you very much for this wonderful interview and wish you best of luck with the following book project.
Thank you very much indeed.